Alice Munro is one of the few fiction writers who's practically worshipped by other writers. Mona Simpson, for instance, says Munro, rather than Bellow or Roth or Updike, is the one living writer most likely to be read 100 years from now. Reviewing her latest book, Runaway, Jonathan Franzen said, Munro has a strong claim to being the best fiction writer now working in North America. What's remarkable is that Alice Munro has earned this reputation entirely from writing short stories. And she's done it largely outside the New York publishing world. Much of her fiction is set in the small towns of southern Ontario, where she was born and where she still lives. Alice Munro is 73 years old. She rarely grants interviews, but she did talk with Steve Paulson, who also spoke with a few of her admirers, some writers, some critics. Steve has the story.
Alice Munro is not one of those writers who hits you over the head with dazzling pyrotechnics or big ideas. Her stories sneak up on you and then pack a wallop. Part of the magic is the way she condenses the essence of a life into a short space, maybe just a paragraph. Here's how her story Dulce begins.
At the end of the summer, Lydia took a boat to an island off the southern coast of New Brunswick, where she was going to stay overnight. She had noticed something about herself on this trip to the Maritimes. It was that people were no longer so interested in getting to know her. It wasn't that she had created such a stir before, but something had been there she could rely on. She was 45 and had been divorced for 9 years. Her two children had started on their own lives, though there were still retreats and confusions. She hadn't gotten fatter or thinner. Her looks had not deteriorated in any alarming way. Nevertheless, she had stopped being one sort of woman and had become another. And she had noticed it on this trip.
Charles McGrath, the former editor of the New York Times Book Review, was Alice Munro's first editor at the New Yorker.
Every one of her stories is kind of a novel compressed into miniature, and there's this kind of overflowing of character, of incident, of detail.
She's not going in there with some modest sense of, I'll spend 3 days and here will be a slice of life. She's going in there trying to recreate the entirety of a life, and then it gets shrunk down to a story, and it's a long story.
And a story, says writer Laurie Moore, that has all the pleasures of a novel. Alice Munro's stories often juggle two or even three narratives from different times in a person's life. You'll have the story that's going on right now, and then you'll suddenly be plunged back years into the past, and only later you'll find out how these two stories connect. And often there's a decisive moment you want to uncover, but as the novelist Charles Baxter points out, an Alice Munro story will keep you guessing.
It's like a Nathaniel Hawthorne story. The one moment, which is the moment of truth, is a moment that is also in some sense unknowable.
Many famous writers have a certain air about them, a grandiosity that comes from years of adulation. For all of her acclaim, Alice Munro is remarkably down to earth and even candid about her humble beginnings. She considers herself an old-fashioned writer, even though she's done so much to reinvent the short story. Remember the old saw about a story needing a beginning, middle, and end, and that a short story is supposed to be short? So don't her stories break all the rules?
Oh, you're telling me they do. I didn't intentionally start out to do this. I didn't know what the rules were, I don't think.
Now, one thing that you do that you're famous for is you play with time.
Oh, yeah.
You jump back and forth between the present and the past.
I just love that.
Why? Why have you? Are you
just Maybe
so
it's
drawn?
Because I've lived a fairly long time. And the things that happen in people's lives over time is just what interests me so much. It sometimes seems quite magical and kind of unbelievable.
Do you have a very vivid memory of past episodes of your own life?
Oh, yes. Yes, I can remember most of the people I went to school with and what color their dresses were and things like that.
Wow, you can actually remember colors
of
dresses.
Well, I do remember things like that, yes.
Because I know for some writers, childhood memories are especially potent. I mean, those are sort of the shaping of one's life.
Oh, well, the memory of my childhood is very strong because, as with many people's childhood, it seems to take place in a sort of different dimension. It's vivid, and it's in a world that seems lost to me now.
When you think back on your childhood, are those for the most part good years for you, or at least happy years?
I don't think they can be characterized as happy or unhappy, but I was not generally in tune with what was expected of me at school or at home. So it was a troubled childhood in some ways.
Do you think that partly made you a writer? That
yes.
In some way you didn't fit in?
I was just bound to become a writer because I was alone a good deal, and I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in anywhere. This is a cliche about writers. You know, you don't fit in, so you start making up your own world and you start living in your imagination or in your mind a lot.
Did you feel like you had to hide that part of yourself from other people?
Goodness, yes. It wasn't very well received. I grew up in a very practical sort of community. It was very important for people to learn how to do things. Girls learned how to do housework things. And I wasn't good at anything. I was terrible, actually. Oh, everybody suspected that I was a dreamer anyway. Everybody saw how much I read. I couldn't hide it. And I think for my own good, people wanted me to be a different kind of person. And in a way, I'm glad of this, you know, because I learned to be a pretty good housewife.
Hmm. Well, I know you have often resisted reading too much autobiography into your stories, but I have to ask you about one of your early stories, The Office. There's a passage where your narrator, a housewife struggling to be a writer, says, "Here comes the disclosure, which is not easy for me. I am a writer. That does not sound right. Too presumptuous, phony, or at least unconvincing. Try again. I write. Is that better? I try to write." Was that you?
Absolutely. That is how I felt when I was a young woman. Because after all, remember, I was a housewife in the 50s. So I went on with the business of hiding myself. I'd had a long training at it, and it wasn't hard for me. But just to think of being a writer, for one thing, even the writers of that period were pretty scornful of women writers, particularly housewife writers. I was always sort of trying to keep my courage up to do what I wanted to do.
Now, the story that I've heard about why you became a short story writer is that you had actually always wanted to be a novelist.
Oh, absolutely.
But you just didn't have time when you had young kids.
Well, I couldn't look forward to time. I couldn't start something and think, well, this is going to take me a year, because I didn't know what would happen in that year.
Now, is it really true that when you were starting out, when you had three young children, you were writing mainly between their naps?
Well, like when they napped, sure. That was the time I got. So I always tried to write things that I could sort of see finishing. Then that got to be, after a while, all I could do.
Alice Munro's big breakthrough, at least for American readers, came in 1977 when she published her first story in The New Yorker. Called Royal Beatings, it was based on the beatings she'd gotten from her own father. The story had nothing in common with the fiction about city and suburban people that filled The New Yorker.
We were very concerned, I was very concerned then, with getting away from the old notion of the, quote, New Yorker story, whatever that was.
Munro's editor, Charles McGrath, says that one story changed the course of modern fiction.
There was also a kind of emotional rawness. I don't think there had ever been a story in The New Yorker quite like Royal Beatings, which frankly acknowledged, I guess what you'd now call it, child abuse of a sort.
At the first, or maybe the second, crack of pain, she draws back. She will not accept it. She runs around the room. She tries to get to the doors. Her father blocks her off. Not an ounce of courage or of stoicism in her, it would seem. She runs. She screams. She implores. Her father is after her, cracking the belt at her when he can, then abandoning it and using his hands. Bang over the ear, then bang over the other ear. Back and forth, her head ringing. Bang in the face. Up against the wall and bang in the face again. He shakes her and hits her against the wall. He kicks her legs. She is incoherent, insane, shrieking. Forgive me. Oh, please, forgive me. Flo is shrieking too. Stop, stop. Not yet. He throws Rose down. Or perhaps she throws herself down. He kicks her legs again. She gives up on words, but is letting out a noise. The sort of noise that makes Flo cry, oh, what if people can hear her? The very last-ditch willing sound of humiliation and defeat it is. For it seems Rose must play her part in this with the same grossness, the same exaggeration that her father displays playing his. She plays his victim with a self-indulgence that arouses, and maybe hopes to arouse, his final sickened contempt.
There may be several reasons Alice Munro has never become a household name. She's Canadian. She only writes short stories. She tends to avoid the media. And she focuses on the lives of girls and women, to cite the title of one of her books. These aren't glamour girls. They're often smart girls from the working class, and women who want more than their mothers had, and more from the men in their lives.
What she's good at is not judging what people do. She's a feminist without being a polemicist, you know. She's looking just at the way women are, not the way they should be.
Laurie Moore says Munro has a particular interest in fate.
What happens to people? What determines how they end up? And she's very interested in the erotic pivot that determines a person's fate. You know, the erotic moment where suddenly everything changes in a person's life, instead of going one way, goes another way.
Alice Munro says love is the subject she keeps coming back to because she's always finding new ways to look at it, especially as she gets older. Her challenge as a writer is to get it right.
In describing anything, the important thing is to seek for some really accurate word that is not a fancy word. There are these dangerous subjects like sex and sunsets and things that there are all kinds of cliches available for. And yet if you really look at them and really think about them, you'll come across what is real.
I've heard writers say that you are able to write about sex, especially from a woman's point of view, like no other writer out there. How do you write well about sex?
Well, it's very difficult, I think. I mean, there's sort of a lot of traps not to fall into. But I think there are different ways of writing about sex that are successful, you know. One of them is the very detailed and explicit sort of genital description way that I don't do, but that some of the shock writers back as far as in the 60s were doing. But the things I do are a little bit cool. I wrote a story that was in the last book called What is Remembered, and that is really a story about how we look back on episodes of passion and what we try to hang on to from them.
What is Remembered is about an older woman who reflects back on a momentous day many years earlier when she was out on a drive with a man who wasn't her husband.
She was holding in a wail of disappointment, a clamor of desire. Desire that had seemed to be shy and sporadic but inevitable, yet was now, all of a sudden, declared inappropriate, one-sided. His hands on the wheel were all his own, reclaimed as if he had never touched her. She wound her window down as they crossed the Lionsgate Bridge. She asked him if he minded. No, not at all. She willed herself to silence. To the forest of the park received them, and the high, thick trees could perhaps swallow witlessness and shame. Then she spoiled everything by her too appreciative sigh. Prospect Point. He read the sign aloud. Her legs were shaking. She could not put up with this any longer. Take me somewhere else, she said. He looked in her face. He said, yes. Take me, was what she had said. Take me somewhere else, not let's go somewhere else. That is important to her. The risk, the transfer of power. Complete risk and transfer. Let's go. That would have the risk, but not the abdication, which is the start for her, in all her reliving of this moment, of the erotic slide.
Alice Munro's stories are not to everyone's taste. Some readers find them too slow, too deliberate. But there are others, like Laurie Moore, who simply marvel at her talent.
It's just a level of greatness. You know, she has so many literary gifts, and she's just at the top of the heap.
The critic James Wood is often brutal in his appraisals, but he also raves about Munro's fiction.
The way those stories start so modestly, then begin to open up like funnels, gently folding in social detail and gentle comedy. They're extraordinary.
So what does Alice Munro make of all the fuss? She didn't seem like the kind of writer who indulges in the parlor game of ranking contemporary authors. Now, you have often been called the greatest living writer of
short
stories.
Oh, go on. No, don't say things like that because they're very embarrassing and they're not true.
But I'm sure you hear these accolades all the time.
I have heard things like that, yes. But I have a Scotch-Irish country girl's background, and you touch wood whenever praise comes to you. You know, you say, oh, I'll pay for this.
That's Alice Munro talking with Steve Paulson. Her new collection of stories is called Runaway. Thanks to Sarah Phillips for her readings.